Welcome to Uses of Spatial Analysis and Decision Assistance, or SPADA, sponsored by EPA's Technology Innovation Program. Today's speakers are Tom Roper and Robert Stewart of the University of Tennessee. And they're the co-developers of Spatial Analysis and Decision Assistance. SPADA is a free software that incorporates tools from experimental fields into a more effective problem-solving environment. Today we'll learn more about it, and I'll let the speakers introduce themselves more fully if they wish, but their bios are, more detailed bios are also available on the webpage you use to log in today. If you have questions, we're going to have the speakers pause occasionally for questions, so those of you that are on the phone line can ask questions. And for those of you that are viewing online, you can click the question button at the top of the presentation to submit a question at any time. And those will also be answered during the QA session. We also may have time at the end of the presentation for questions.
Okay.
Yeah, if one more reminder is please, everybody, please mute your phone lines so they don't hear any background noise. And with that, I'll throw it over to our speakers.
Hello, my name is Robert Stewart. I am with the University of Tennessee in the Institute for Environmental Modeling. Along with Tom, I am one of the primary developers of the SPADA software. Tom?
Yeah, I'm Tom Peruca. I work in the Institute for Environmental Modeling also, mostly on the risk assessment and statistical pieces of the software. I am about to start a postdoc with the EPA down in the Athens laboratory next week. I think Robert's going to start us off, and then what we're going to do is we're going to switch between the two of us talking as we move through this presentation.
Okay. All right, so we'll get underway with the first slide. This is sort of just provides general information on the SPADA software package. SPADA was originally designed to provide human health risk assessors with a way to visualize their data and sort of spatially aggregate their data within a human health risk context. Since then, since that was about 1996 or so, the effort seriously got underway, SPADA has sort of evolved into quite a collection of a sort of mainstream tools, all residing within this sort of spatial context. So what we see here are a number of the major sort of a broad generalization of the major models of SPADA. So we have visualization and GIS. There are folks who actually use SPADA as sort of a GIS alternative and to actually make a few maps and to plot their data. We also allow the integration of or import of ARC shapefiles. But perhaps more importantly, we allow users to bring in what we call data exchange format files, or DXF files. These are files that are sort of the text files of the GIS industry. Most major GIS packages can export out a layer as a DXF file. And say that you can read those in and you have some control over them. SPADA does provide some GIS capabilities, beyond being able to see the maps and see your data plotted. We do offer some capabilities in, you know, querying metadata, and those kinds of things. However, the main purpose of SPADA was to create a spatial modeling tool that would really support decision analysis. We do offer a few decision frameworks within SPADA, largely targeted still at environmentalists. But we've found that there have been quite a few applications of SPADA, not only environmental, but in engineering, and lately we've seen some epidemiological applications of SPADA. So it turns out that it becomes useful for a wide range of applications where you have spatially distributed information. Beyond the visualization in GIS, we see we have some statistical analyses. Those statistical analyses are your classical sort of statistics. And then we have a way to sort of quantify spatially what's going on through some, standard sort of spatial interpolation models. We draw from some deterministic methods as well as geostatistical toolbox. And along with those, there are some spatial uncertainty analysis that the state is capable of performing. What really gets interesting after that is how we're able to integrate human health risk models. Tom will talk more about those in detail, except to say these are the standard sort of risk models that come out of the risk assessment guidance for Superfund. They can use, like all the other tools of standard, they can be used independently or in concert with the spatial tools. In other words, one could open up SEDA, import some data, and sort of perform a standard sort of human health risk assessment with your tables and charts and such, or you're able to connect those to the spatial models to sort of make risk-based decisions. Same thing for ecological risk assessment, sort of an expansive sort of ever-growing module of SEDA that Tom will talk about. And for those of you who have stuff outside of what SEDA can do, maybe state guidelines or local site-specific criteria that's not really going to be generated, say, per se, from your own human health or ecological risk, you can actually import those in as decision criteria. You'll see more of that later under the custom analysis. More recently, we have the MARSIM module. The MARSIM stands for the Multi-Agency Radiological Site Survey Investigation Manual. And what that is sort of a guidance that's sort of been agreed upon between NRC, the EPA, and I believe the DOE on how to approach radiological contamination, how to determine if it's been cleaned up, the surface application guidance. You can learn more about that. All of this then becomes sort of wrapped up in some sort of decision. So we presumably are taking the time to explore the data, to go through to the trouble of doing these modeling in order to come up with some sort of decision. And that decision can be in the form of an area of concern. Where should we enact some sort of remedial process? What parts can we let go? That can be, SEDA risk-based, and it can also be risk not only in terms of human health, but in terms of probability of an event, risk in that sense. We also can tie those to some rudimentary cost-benefit analyses that sort of say, well, if we allow the area of concern decision to sort of vary, how will that result in, really, the volume of removal or the total cost it would be associated with cleaning it up? But above and beyond all these, we sort of have as bookends to the front and to the back of what we call sort of a logical flow through SEDA, we have sampling designs. And there are quite a suite of initial sample designs available, as well as secondary designs that sort of help you refine your knowledge about the site based on what data you have and what your spatial models might be indicating. In the latest version of SEDA, we are able to export some of these results out to JIG files or even to EarthVision for those of you who may use that software to have a more sophisticated, I guess, three-dimensional view. I should say that SEDA does come with a three-dimensional viewer. It's pretty decent. It is sort of our house brand of a 3D viewer. If in the event you are not able to have access to EarthVision. So SEDA has been supported by the DOE, EPA, and NRC. And we've been pretty successful, if you consider our downloads. It's quite a few for version 3. It looks like we're going to beat that for version 4. It is a free software package. So any of you can certainly download it and start working with it on your own. Go to slide 2. Here on slide two, I sort of cover a little bit more information about it, in particular, how to get the software, also what kind of documentation we provide. We've got a pretty substantial help file. Like most help files, it's sort of topic-oriented, and that can be good or bad, depending upon where you're coming from. We also publish our verification document, which you don't see a lot of that, online, so you can look and see what kind of detail we're verifying the code in. I believe the version 4 verification plan is up. I'll have to double-check that now that I think about it. And we do provide trainings. We do on-site trainings for people that request it. We do have a training once a semester here at the university. We have one coming up in October through the professional development office here. And we've noticed in the last few years an increasing strong international interest in SATA. Right now we're looking at probably 50% of the downloads are coming outside of the U.S. This is quite surprising to us. And we've actually been able to engage in some training over there. More recently, some training a year or so ago, a couple of years now, I guess, in Brazil and in Sweden. So we're enjoying that part of it. Go to page 3 now.
All right, Tom here with the comprehensive help file slide. We'll get into some of the specifics of what we can do with SATA in a minute, but I just want to go through a little bit more with some of the documentation issues. The help file, as Robert just mentioned, it's a very large help file. It's 14 megabytes big, and it has a number of different help file topics and pretty much comprehensively covers all the different things you can do in SATA. A lot of times you'll get help files along with software that only cover some of the basics or don't go into any detail. We put a lot of time and effort into making sure that we comprehensively cover all the different aspects of SATA in terms of both how you implement them as well as references on where certain equations come from or where even to the point of for human health and for ecological risk, where our default values come from as they're populated from different EPA guidance documents. We also have a number of external links from the help file to actually go to sources of information. For example, for ecological benchmarks, we'll have direct links from the help file to those original sources, so you can verify the information that's in SATA versus those original sources. A lot of you probably found SATA online through a Google search or some sort of similar search engine. A lot of that is because we have this entire help file also on our webpage. So you can also, without using the software, go to our help file topics there on the webpage, and you'll see a lot of the same sort of information. That information often scores high on different sorts of internet searches for various aspects of environmental assessment that SATA covers. The SATA help file is also context sensitive, so if you're working in a particular area of SATA and you'll hit the F1 button or the help button, it'll actually come up with a particular help file topic that will help you in whatever you're trying to accomplish in SATA. Just a bit more about the web page. There's also a variety of other types of information on that web page. Robert mentioned some of the training information, and the our next training information is at the end of October. It's the 25th through 27th, Wednesday through Friday, that we do at the training center. We have the quality assurance information, like Robert says, for the different versions of SATA that we produced up through version 4. And there's also a comprehensive list of references where SATA has been used, whether journal articles or EPA guidance documents or particular projects for different sponsors where people have used SATA. We've sort of compiled a rather extensive list of different people that have used SATA in that sort of fashion. Moving on to the next overhead, is the SATA User's Guide. And while some people just don't like help files and prefer to have a document that they can print out and thumb through and find stuff at their leisure, we have that as well. The SATA User's Guide is over 300 pages long. It's up on the web page as a PDF file, so you can download it and print it out if you so choose. When we first created this user's guide, we didn't really think people would be interested in downloading it and printing printing it out because it was so large. But we went ahead, since we've gone through all this effort to produce it, we went ahead and put it up on the webpage. But we've really been surprised at the number of people who have taken it, printed out the whole thing, and then pointed out errors on page 226, and that sort of thing. So, as we've gotten different reports on errors, we've updated it as we could. But these are just generally, goes through the main topics of SATA. You'll see different chapters on how to get started in SATA, how SATA files work, what kind of information they contain, what the basic functions of SATA are, some background on geospatial methods and how they're implemented in SATA, as well as risk assessment methods for human health and ecological risk, as well as some of the decision frameworks and three-dimensional. Pretty much all the different categories of SATA are covered in this user's guide in addition to the help file. Moving on to educational use of SATA, which is slide 5. What we've done over the years, on the early versions of SATA were somewhat difficult to use even for experienced users. So what we've done through the successive versions is make a significant effort to make each version easier to use. And Robert will talk more about this in a bit, but this last version, 4.0 and 4.1, which is similar, has some big increases in the ability of users just to sort of walk right in and get going with the SATA file. Along with that, when we put out version 4, we started seeing an increase in the number of students that were downloading SATA. For the most part, these are undergraduate students in environmental science type programs. And what we saw happening was that some instructors were out there, since SATA is free, they can install it on their own laboratory computers, that different university instructors were using SATA as a tool for teaching GIS and various environmental assessment concepts in a environmental science curriculum. So we've been sort of working to support that, developing an educational resource website on the SATA page, as well as some example files and just background information for instructors who want to use SATA in an educational environment. And there are no restrictions there for downloading SATA and putting it on on a network type of implementation so that a variety of students can go through and use SATA in that fashion. So we'll go back to Robert for slide 6.
So in slide 6, we basically sort of itemize a list of the major sort of things that people would want to do in SATA. I've already covered a lot of these in the opening slide. You can certainly see that that there are a number of them there. The top left-hand corner, we have our initial sample designs, the ability to import data, plot it. Again, we see our GIS layers, statistics. And then from there on down, those of you who have done some spatial analysis will be familiar with these kind of things. We have some tools for modeling spatial correlation, contour maps, kriging stuff. And then we, of course, as I mentioned before, and Tom will talk more about, we have the traditional human health and sort of eco-risk assessments. You can do those as tabular risk screens, DRG, benchmarks, and those kind of tables. But then they can also be merged to see these within a spatial context, either by running data spatially, point-wise data through these models, or through running the results of the spatial contour through them. And so you can see a variety of those. And then over on the right-hand side, about a third of the way down, we pick up with, actually at the top of the right-hand side, we see there's such things as probability maps that sort of help us understand uncertainty. Areas of concern I've talked about, cost, LISA maps kind of give us an indication of spatial quality of our data, and so on and so forth. Now, one of the things that's important to know, that we try to engineer in this SATA, is that SATA's environment interface, when you start working with it, does try to help guide you through these through these choices. But it doesn't hardwire you into any sort of flow structure. It's a fairly open environment, and we think that that's why it ends up having a lot of applications in other areas as well. So I think we're going to sort of proceed through discussing these features of SATA, kind of from an environmental model or environmental characterization standpoint, beginning sort of with initial sample designs and possibly ending up with some sort of a decision outcome, maybe some secondary sample designs. And so we're going to present this material kind of in the way that one might present or attack an environmental contamination scenario. So if we move on to slide 7, talk a bit about the sample designs that are in SEDA. There are two broad categories, as I mentioned. There's initial designs and there are secondary designs. On the left-hand side of that pseudo-chart you see there are some representative types of initial designs we have. Nothing that you probably haven't seen before in one way or another. We have sort of systematic grids, sort of put down regularly patterned rectangular or triangular grid. We have, as a part of all those, you may be familiar with the ELIP grid, sort of hotspot search routines that sort of calculate how far our samples have to be apart in order to find a contamination event of a certain size. Then we have sort of a series of random sample design strategies with a couple of different options for how to carry those out. And then finally, and those different systematic and hotspot search grids, there's, I don't know, I haven't counted in a while, there's 10, 11, 12 different sort of permutations of those. I'd be overstating that, but I think it's quite a few. And then among those, we have one called judgmental, which basically allows users who don't like the other designs, basically, to sort of place samples graphically where they want to on the site based on the their knowledge about what's going on the site. Perhaps there's an area they want to target more than others. And they just want to use SEDA as sort of a communication tool for placing samples and getting their coordinates output to a sampling team and also to visualize where they would go. On the right-hand side of that, we see secondary designs. Secondary designs really come at the end of the process. They're only mentioned here in a sense, because there is a new feature in SEDA referred to as the Geobayesian model. The Geobayesian model allows you to describe and spatially delineate where you think that the problem areas of the site are going to be before any sampling is done. So, you know, sort of a based on historical information, based on long ago sampling efforts, based on eyewitness accounts, what have you, you may have an area that you think is more likely to be contaminated than another. These are sort of what we call informed sample designs. The initial designs you see to the left, with the exception of judgmental, would be what we call uninformed designs. No knowledge about them, about what might be going on out there. And to the right, we can see that there are a couple of designs there that one can certainly use on a site conceptual model. One is the high-value design, which places samples, as you might expect, where you're most likely to get a hit on your site. And then we have an area of concern boundary design, where you may want to try to better refine or delineate the line between what we call, you might decide based on the criteria, contaminated versus non-contaminated. And those will take on more meaning, I think, as we move forward in the demonstration. And there are a number of secondary designs that I'm going to include on the right-hand side. We will be able to go through those today. Move on to slide 8.
All right, maybe this is a good time to ask if there are any questions about sample designs or just what we've discussed so far with the general overview of SEDA.
Yeah, this is Ram speaking from Air Force, U.S. Air Force.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yep.
This is Ram Bhatt speaking from U.S. Air Force. My question is, suppose we have got a site where we have buried up, we don't know how many 55-gallon drums have been buried in a burial site, and we are thinking what is the best way to design how many samples we have to take. We've got limited funding. And how to take this, how do you know how many 5 gallons are there? We don't have any records. This is done about 50 years ago. And so what kind of design or what kind of things we have to take? Is there any kind of ultrasound or infrared, any other scanning we have to do it? What is your suggestion?
You're saying that you have a series of dump locations, but you're not sure how many or where?
Yeah, how many are there? We don't know anything. What is the dump there?
Yeah, I mean...
How many are radioactive, how many are non-radioactive, or it's mixed?
It would sound to me like that you probably need... I would begin, suggest beginning with some sort of geophysical sort of examination of the site, see what parts of the site have been disturbed. I think there are sampling tools capable of doing that. What we're really talking about here, I guess, in a way, is, where you actually take a sample, a core sample, for example, take it back to the lab and analyze it. But if you're in a situation where you have a large site, you're looking for potentially small dumps, dump locations, it may be just too cost prohibitive to to just take on an uninformed sort of sample design. It would seem like it would benefit from some sort of geophysical characterization. Might be more cost effective for you, Tom. I don't know, do you?
We have roughly about 1 acre site, and typically we have opened one of the sites. It's about 30 feet deep, about 1 acre area. The site area is about 30 feet deep, and the water table about 100 feet below this surface. So what do you recommend? Another person was to suggest. Go ahead, sir.
Well, the SATA does, I was just going to point out that SATA does have hotspot search routines in their initial sample design. So if you have an idea of how big a hotspot is or how many hotspots you have and you want to have a certain confidence in detecting one of those hotspots, you can get an answer back with exactly how many samples it would take given those types of input criteria. But when you're looking for 55-gallon drums over a large site, that's going to be a prohibitive number of samples. So as Robert said, you need to be looking at geophysical types of methods to help detect those drums. But SATA, SATA is a software tool. It's not a geophysical type of tool. If I can just move on to the next slide, we can talk about the kind of data that SATA does take in terms of chemical data, and maybe we can follow up with your question after the talk is concluded.
Thank you.
Okay. So moving on to slide 8, sample laboratory data. This is just a snapshot of typical data sets that you might import in the SATA. And we just wanted to be explicit with exactly what sort of data SATA would import and what you'd be using SATA on. So this is essentially an Excel spreadsheet of a typical contaminant results file that you get from the laboratory. It has different fields for project name, project number, date collected, end light, results, etc. And this is the kind of data that after you've designed, you can use SATA with an empty file and just some GIS information and design an initial sample design. But then when you send your samplers out there in the field to collect data and get your lab results back, this is the type of lab result data that you would then be importing into SATA. So SATA is not necessarily a fate and transport tool, although there are some simple types of fate and transport assumptions that are embedded in the ecological and human health risk approaches. But for the most part, we're dealing with laboratory data, which is what most people import data into SATA with when they're using it. We can also handle, for visualization purposes, modeled output, so maybe you have different model results over time that you want to view in the context of your site. SATA can also handle that type of information. But for your laboratory data, when it comes in from the lab, there is some pre-processing that is necessary to do in order to get that into SATA and create a SATA file. So if we move on to the next slide, which is slide 9, titled Data Formats, you'll see that SATA, most people use Microsoft Excel to pre-process the data in such a way as to strip, for example, less than and and that type of thing to make sure that the fields are in the proper format for importing this data, and then save that same data file as either a Commons limited file, and we can also work with Microsoft Access files in order to import an original data set into SATA. So there are a certain number of fields that are required by SATA when you do an import, and these are pretty much the simplest fields you would have, which would be X, Y, Z coordinates for the easting, the northing, and the depth associated with that sample location. And then you'd have a name. Usually it's a contaminant name in an environmental assessment context, but Robert mentioned some other types of applications, so it doesn't always have to be contaminant names. And then a numerical value associated with that particular sample result. So, for example, if we were importing a data file and we had some less than results, it's you need to go ahead and strip off the less than qualifier just so it's a numerical result. For example, less than 0.005 would be turned into 0.005. And then we have other forms of information, other fields that can be imported along with this data import process. And those include a detection flag. So if you had a less than you have this detect field that was specified 0 for non-detects and 1 for detects. We also have a media field. SATA will do different types of risk assessment analyses based upon which media you have. So SATA recognizes soil, sediment, surface water, groundwater, air, background, as well as biota as different types of media types. If you do not specify a media type, then SATA will just have a generic media value called basic. You can also include a date as date collected as a field in your import data set, and then SATA will allow you to perform some data queries so that you can look for different date ranges for when data was collected when you're performing data visualization and other assessment techniques. And there are many forms, other fields that you may require to be imported. These are just, in SATA's context, these are just metadata that are additional fields that you can import, and we allow you to apply that as labels within the GIS so that you can see who sampled which sample locations, for example, or any sort of qualifying notes that you might have associated with particular samples can be displayed as a label on the GIS window. But that's just a sort of a quick overview of some of the data format considerations. And again, the stress is that SATA is really an empirical tool for visualizing your data as well as performing different environmental assessment techniques, including risk assessment and statistical and spatial analysis type of methods, and not so much a fate and transport tool. But we'll move on to slide 10, and Robert with a scalable interface.
Maybe we ought to take a moment here to see if there are any questions about SATA.
Yeah, quick question on your slide number 8, the sample laboratory data. Do you have a field for qualifiers too?
Part of the pre-processing in SATA would be to go ahead and evaluate those qualifiers. For example, if you have qualifiers that say whether or not a particular sample value is detected or non-detected, then what you would do is evaluate those qualifiers and assign it a value of 1 or 0 in the detection flag field so the SATA knows whether...
So what I mean is the data validation qualifier, like rejected or estimated.
Yes. So, yeah, that's what I'm talking about, too. If you have those J different qualifier, we don't really have time in this context to go through all the different qualifiers, but usually what we do is we have the user pre-process the data so that essentially you would either quantitatively or qualitatively evaluate all those qualifiers that are associated with your different samples and then perhaps remove data from your data set that needs to be rejected or simply assign a particular record as non-detected due to the qualifiers that you found.
Okay.
So, sure. Any other questions?
Tom and Robert, this is Dean Barron here from the EPA Technology Innovation Program. I'm with Mike Adams, and we've got a few questions that were submitted online.
Okay.
Reading them off to you. The first one, this goes back to your help file. This is from John Robert Seaman with US EPA in Chicago. He wants to know if it's a good resource to learn more about general risk assessment.
So the risk assessment, documentation in the help file is pretty extensive, so it doesn't substitute for EPA guidance in terms of learning the ins and outs of how to perform a risk assessment, but it is pretty thorough in the sense that all the equations are documented. There is some description of the processes for human health and for ecological risk assessment, and there is tie-ins to a lot of the both basic references for learning about risk assessment as well as specific references for parameterizing the different exposure models that are found in the risk assessment pieces. So it is a resource for risk assessment, maybe not the best one for learning from scratch, but it is very thorough and contains a lot of detail.
Hey, this is Raquel McDonald from FDEP. Going the other way, is it customizable? We use some different toxicity factors and stuff like that in our risk assessments. Does this have the capability to customize it to a different application rather than EPA guidance?
Certainly. We'll get more into detail for both human health and ecological risk assessment later, but all the default exposure parameters for the different land use scenarios, as well as the toxicity information that we get from IRIS and HEAST and PAC along with SEDA, those can all be changed to reflect site-specific values or region-specific considerations when performing a local risk assessment. And we'll see and talk a little bit more about that in a bit.
There's another question that came online. They want to know if there's a Spanish version of SEDA available.
No, that's something we've talked about. But we don't have, no, we don't. We've also just like to have a Spanish web page up at some point, just to do a straight translation of our English web page and put it up in Spanish, as well as perhaps have a flag to allow SEDA to be run in Spanish, but we do not have that and have not been funded to do that to date.
I have another question. They wanted Barry Davidson from URS is asking, how large of a database can SEDA handle? He has a large site with a few million data points from a gamma scan with GPS.
I was just encouraging him to try it, although that kind of data, that volume of data, 2 million, you might find that it runs a little slow. I would suggest that you certainly give it a try. But our experiences have been a few hundred thousand, close to a million, it starts acting slow. Say it was originally designed sort of to target small sites, but smaller sites, so medium-sized sites with tens of thousands of data points instead of hundreds of thousands to millions. But we'd be interested in knowing. I would say also on the question about the qualifiers on the data that Tom was talking about, say it does like you have a zero or one qualifier. It basically just comes down to is it a detect or not, is all the city cares about. But you should certainly include in your data set the original qualifier, and SEDA will allow you to import that so that you can see whether it was a U or a J or what have you.
Two more questions quickly. Lorraine Wright wants to know, do you need surface elevation along with the depth of the sample to get the Z coordinates?
The surface elevation, right now SEDA only looks at depth below surface. Okay. However, this version that we're working on right now for the NRC will have elevation data, it'll be able to use elevation data along with depth so that you can get, see truly in 3D space what it looks like, the hills and the valleys and the ditches and stuff like that. But the version of SEDA that is out there at this time, is only depth below the surface.
And one last question from Scott Munson. Is SEDA able to calculate the volume of soil above the specified cleanup level and show locations of this material?
It absolutely can. That's one of the major outcomes of this decision framework. Now, regarding the Spanish translation, we have been interested in getting a Spanish translation of our documents, and something we may try to pursue. I would add, and Tom can help me clarify this, if I'm saying anything wrong, that there was a Portuguese translation, was there not, Tom? I'm sorry?
At one point there was a Spanish translation of the Getting Started Guide, but I don't think that is currently on the webpage because it's outdated.
Okay. So I guess, can we go ahead?
Yep.
Okay, so we're now on slide 10, the state of interface, scalable interfacing. I'd like to go ahead and skip this slide. It's a bit out of place. I'd like to continue on now to slide 11. At the end, if I have time to return to that, we'll talk about that a bit. But I'd like to continue on with the data issue. So Tom talked about what the data looks like, how you get it into SATA. SATA actually has as a reminder, SATA has sort of a little data import wizard that kind of helps lead you through the process of getting your data in. Once you get your data into SATA, you're immediately presented with your data in a spatial context, right off the bat. So you can see the kind of things you're able to do very readily in SATA. We have our standard data plot or GIS overlays. It's not necessary that you have any GIS overlays to use SATA. If you don't have an overlay, SATA will simply show you a standard XY sort of scaled axis plot, and that'll be the first thing you see. You can see that SATA has a legend, which appears with most pictures, that customize the color scheme. Those folks who have not seen this kind of thing before, it's pretty simple. Basically, the brighter the color, the higher the contamination level, and the darker the color, the lower. You can make that relative to the data you have, or you can fix those to more meaningful values. Then to the upper right, we see that you're able to right off the bat do some very simple spatial data screens. You can do those screens, or these little boxes that sort of highlight data values that are in excess of some criteria. Now, that criteria could just be something you just type in yourself at the keyboard, or it could be the result or outcome of a human health model run that you've done in SATA. It might be something you brought in from the outside through a custom analysis, or perhaps the result of an ecological benchmark screen. So what we're looking at here, though, is the scan or the screen of one particular contaminant. In fact, I think this is, I'm not sure what the contaminant here is, but you're able to do that for multiple contaminants. You're able to sort of peruse through your list of contaminants. And SATA also has a way to sort of see all this at once by pooling the data all together, so you can sort of run tabular screens on all your data at once. To the lower right, we see the polygon selection cutaways. These are simple polygon drawing tools that allow you to subset your site and take more localized areas of interest. Once you subset a site like that, your analysis, your human health, your statistics, your whatever analysis you're running is now confined to the data inside of the polygon, the area inside of the polygon. And then you're able to do your basic statistical calculations, univariate statistics in this case. And so those sort of appear as tabular values on the lower left-hand corner. If you're able to zoom in far enough, you can see that there's actually each row represents a particular contaminant, and each column represents a statistical value. So this is sort of the result of doing a pooled data. You'll see more about that, hopefully, when you get involved with SATA. Moving on to slide 12, Tom has programmed in a number of statistical calculations into SATA, from the univariate statistics, which there's quite a few up there of your standard sort of data qualifiers. Then these are some hypothesis testing. At this point, we have some non-parametric hypothesis tests that are kind of come out of the work we did for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission on the MARSIM module. And so those are available within or without the MARSIM module. There's some power curves that indicate to us appropriate sample sizes based on these non-parametric tests. Again, these kind of come from the MARSIM development that we did. And then you have some typical histograms and CDFs that are usually can be pretty helpful in understanding behavior of your data. Moving on to slide 13, there are actually two halves to SATA, if you want. Think of it that way. There's sort of the data analysis half. So we're talking about visualizing data, querying data, perusing through our contaminants, doing statistics, doing human health risks, doing what have you, but all on the data. Sort of the second half of SATA is based on spatial analysis. And the foundation of these spatial analyses is typically a spatial interpolation model. And they vary in their complexity. But the basic idea behind a spatial interpolation scheme, all of those in SATA, is that you're typically wanting to predict now what a sample would be at a location that you've not sampled at yet. Alright, so if you look there in the center, you can see I've got some green dots, which represent sample locations that we actually collected. And perhaps the empty dot in the center is the one that we'd like to know, predict what it will be. And the way most of these work, with the exception of a couple, is you end up having some sort of an area of influence or search neighborhood that indicates what samples will be used in determining that value. And then the samples contribute or participate in estimating the value at the unsampled location according to some weight which is assigned to them. Okay? So you'd imagine that samples that are much further away would typically have a smaller weight or a smaller influence on the predicted value at that point. Now, the way that these weights are determined is really the differences between the different interpolation routines, different analysis routines. Some of them weight strictly as a function of distance. The more sophisticated geostatistical models actually try to model, assign a weight based on an observed spatial correlation structure that's actually measured in the data. Now, for those that are not familiar with geostatistics, you need not worry. We're not going to go too far into that, except to say that geostatistics provides what we call a stochastic or statistical-based approach to spatial modeling that instead of just producing a single contour, for example, inverse distance, natural neighbor, even routines not insane like minimum tension gradient bird vision, these are all what we call deterministic methods. And these deterministic methods produce a single answer for any point you want to know about. The stochastic methods actually produce probability distributions at each point. In other words, rather than a single value, there's sort of a range of values that the concentration might be at that point. Well, this provides a measure of uncertainty, or a model, I should say, of uncertainty. And we can take advantage of that later on in our decision frameworks and in our sampling designs, our secondary sampling designs. But typically, people are not really interested in just knowing what a value is or what a potential range of values might be at a location. They want to actually see a sort of a continuous pretty map. And so typically one will specify a grid, which you can sort of see the outcome of this in the lower right-hand corner of slide 13. Sort of specify a grid, and in the center of each grid, we end up calculating the estimated value, sort of producing a continuous sort of looking map. So the idea behind the spatial analysis is that you want to go from some sort of map of discrete finite points through a process, in this case, those that are familiar with geostatistics, some sort of modeling process that produces for us what we see in the lower right-hand corner, an estimate of what contamination may look like on a particular site, given what we know at the moment. Now, to reinforce it, models like geostatistics are able to go a step further and produce a map of spatial uncertainty. As you see in the lower left-hand corner, the legend now is no longer concentration values, but rather probability values. So in this case, we have a decision threshold in mind, say 3 picocuries per gram, and we want to know what's the probability or likelihood that we exceed that value across the site. So spatial models are only an indication or estimation of what we might know right now about the site. Typically, sites are much more heterogeneous than what you see here. And we are looking at ways in the upcoming version of SATA to make these results a little more heterogeneous looking, to incorporate what we call secondary or soft information to make more realistic maps. However, these are a pretty good start and sort of indicate our status of knowledge at the time. These spatial maps sort of then serve as a springboard for us to identify hotspots or areas of concern, or perhaps even where might we put more samples to really test that this model is predicting accurately, or to reinforce this model where it simply says, I don't know. In the case on the lower left-hand corner, you'll see there the probability map, the spatial uncertainty map. One indication of I don't know kind of comes about in the form of the green areas. If you look at the green areas on that slide, that's about the 50-50 mark. So we're asking, what's the probability of exceeding 3 picocuries per gram there? So it is basically saying, I have no idea. Okay, so it might be useful to help delineate that boundary a little bit by putting some samples in that location. And there are many, many other motivations for where you put samples to support a model. Slide 15 is sort of a sidebar for a moment for those who are familiar with geostatistical modeling. For those of you who are not, just bear with us for a moment. One of the critical steps in a geostatistical analysis is in fact the evaluation of spatial correlation or spatial structure on a site. And spatial correlation basically means sort of that describes how well data are, how alike data are as a function of distance. So for example, if I were to take a sample here next to my chair and take a sample across the room next to the office door, I would suspect that on average that those two samples will be more alike than if I take a sample 6-8 miles away. Now that's sort of an extreme case, but I think it gets the point across that on average, things that are closer together are more alike than things that are far away. And we can measure that tendency, to behave that way through these correlation modeling tools. And for those that are familiar with, how this is done, we have now in version 4 a barygram map, or what we call a Rose diagram, which is up in the left-hand corner, that allows you to visualize correlation strengths in all directions at once. So you can sort of look for directions in which the correlation strength is stronger than in others. So we, those that have worked with this know that sometimes it's not just how far away things are, but also in what direction they are. And an extreme example of that would be, for example, a ditch scenario. If you have a situation where you're sampling inside a highly contaminated ditch, maybe the ditch is 2, 3, 4 feet wide, at the top of the ditch is very little contamination, then you would imagine that there would be a strong, what we call anisotropic conditions, meaning that correlation strengths would be quite strong in the direction of the ditch. So, you know, you're down in the ditch and you're sampling. If you walk up and down the ditch, you would expect there to be a stronger relationship between those data values than if you were to take samples in the ditch and then out of the ditch. I'm not sure if that's modeling tools help detect that and sort of provide sort of evidence not only of this presence of spatial correlation, but also how to parameterize the geostatistical models later. We have several varigram model tools and varigram models that you can fit, and we have added sort of a correlation auto-fit routine that sort of helps you through this process. And I think I'll continue on now. I think Tom's going to start talking about spatial mutation risk, but maybe we should stop for a second for questions.
And we have some questions on the webpage now. One from Gary Davidson. What types of software can be used to bring in images, for example, a map of the site in the background? I'll just say that there are two types of ways to bring in background layers. That is through AutoCAD DXF files, as well as ARC shape files. And Robert, maybe you want to say something about plans for bringing in actual images.
Yes.
Backgrounds.
Yeah, version 5, which is the beta version of 5, is slated to be released in March, and we hope to get the final version out by May or June of next year. It will have the capability of bringing in photographic overlays, raster images, if you will, that you can actually lay down and then perhaps even put shape files over the top of it. So that is up and coming.
There's another question from Steve Cardone from Virginia. He said, you said that the current SATA version does not allow for evaluating surface soil samples. Is a depth such as 0.5 feet allowed? And we didn't mean to give the impression that SATA does not allow for evaluating surface soil samples, and you can have depths and define different depth layers, as well as view data in three dimensions, which we'll get to towards the end of the discussion.
In fact, probably the majority of SATA applications are actually surface applications. And by surface, well, surface means two-dimensional to us. So it could be that your data are 0 to 6 inches or literally zero below the surface. The point I was trying to make about the elevation data is that unfortunately, if you were to sample on the side of a hill, we can't show you the hill. We can show you, though, sort of an orthogonal projection if you were to look at your hill, say, from a helicopter. You can look down and see where your samples are going to be and the results of those. If that helps or hurts, I don't know.
Okay. From Carl Steinman of Chicago, we have concentrations and risk often span several orders of magnitude. Is there any way to display concentrations or risks on a continuous logarithmic color scale? And the answer is yes. There's a couple different ways to control the legend and the color scaling in SATA. By default, it's just a continuous color scale from the minimum to the maximum of the observed data for the contaminant in the media that you're looking at. But there are also logarithmic displays. For this is often used for human health risk, for example, for probability of increased cancer risk. And there are also different ways to customize that, so you can create your own sort of custom scales and play with the color banding and put in discrete breakpoints in the legend. So that is not something that we have time to get into during the seminar, but it is something that is possible in SATA. Our next question is from California, Nova Kleit. For spatial data analysis, do you need to know if your data are normally or log-normally distributed? I'll let you answer that one, Robert.
It depends upon what you're going to do. The deterministic methods that are in SATA, and when those would be nearest neighbor, natural neighbor, and inverse distance, they make no assumptions whatsoever about the distribution of your data. They just are simple geometric estimations of concentration. Kriging, ordinary Kriging and indicator Kriging represent the geostatistical side of SATA. Ordinary Kriging, whether or not the data are normally or log-normally distributed in ordinary Kriging is not as not too important until you start looking at the model of spatial uncertainty. Okay, so kind of rooted in theory of random field models, but the idea is kriging, the act of ordinary kriging, produces a what we call a kriging mean and a kriging variance. Okay? Now, if you simply use the kriging mean, it's been demonstrated in literature that kriging means are pretty robust against a variety of skewed distributions. But if you are now going to say that that's not just the mean, a deterministic answer, that actually is the mean of my distribution, and I'm going to use the kriging variance as the variance of my distribution, then you're in a little bit of trouble, because you're going to need, the way it works out, it needs to be normally distributed. The data needs to be normally distributed, which we know doesn't ever happen. So what does that mean? Well, what it means that you have to do is you have to go through going through a normal score transform, which actually used to be in a very, very old version of SATA. And we took it out, and I have no idea why we do such a thing. I'm responsible for it, so I did it. I need to get it back in. Or you need to think more carefully about using the indicator kriging method that's in SATA. The indicator kriging method is a non-parametric approach. And actually, when I see data that are log normally distributed, I tend to want to use the indicator kriging approach, because it doesn't make any assumption about the distribution of the data. It is like a lot of non-parametric methods in statistics. It has its little quirks. But the thing I'll emphasize about indicator kriging is when you go in there, you're going to be asked to sort of discretize the range of your data. Alright? And what you want to concentrate on doing when you discretize that range of your data is you want to not make it uniformly. You're not going to pick, like say I have data range from 0 to 10, and it's log normally distributed. I'm not going to pick I'm not going to pick representative locations of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I'm going to pick representative locations of 0.1, 0.2, 0.3, 0.4, 0.5, then maybe 1, 2, and 3, so that I real accurately delineate the curve of the distribution I have. Now, that's a lot to take in right now, I realize. I'm not sure that it's even on this page. I'm scrolling ahead. But I would like to, at this time, make a couple of recommendations about some references that you might want to take a look at. One of those references is Applied Geostatistics by I'm looking for another training slide. Srivastava and I apologize for the pause. I'll be with you in just one moment. The references I'm talking about would be I'm looking at another slide that's slow, as you can't see. Oh, here we go. Applied Geostatistics. That's Applied Geostatistics by Isaacs and Srivastava. This is an excellent, excellent book that gets you started on understanding the principles of geospatial analysis. It's a book I wish I had when I had started. Another good book is actually the Geostatistical Software Library, GSLab, by Deutsche Journal. It's put out actually by Stanford. And SATA is actually sort of based on some of those geostatistical routines in GSLab. And a couple more. There's a good one for environmentalists called Geostatistics for Natural Resource Evaluation by Pierre Gouverts. So there are three books there that I'd recommend and can really help support your understanding of geostatistics.
Can you spell the author's last name, please?
The last author's name? Yes.
Applied Geostatistics?
Yes, Applied Geostatistics.
Yeah.
I apologize for the slide not being in there. The authors are Isaacs, I-S-A-A-K-S, and the other author's last name is Srivastava, S-R-I-V-A-S-T-A-V-A.
Thank you.
Yeah.
How about the GS Lab one?
The authors there are Deutsch and Jernell. So the first one is spelled D E U T S C H, and the other one is Jernell, which is J O U R N E L.
And we just got a question about, are the references cited listed anywhere in the help file or the user's guide? And I believe that they are in both the help file and the user's guide. So there's our, you can get more of that type of information as well as additional references in those sources. Two more questions. In your spatial uncertainty analysis, can you predict the uncertainty associated with the predicted value at a given point? And this is related to the Cregan discussion that Robert just discussed.
Right. So the if we go back to slide 14, the spatial analysis slide. We see on the right-hand side a spatial estimation map. It's actually a sort of a matrix of blocks, a grid, if you will, of blocks. And for each one of those blocks, say that it's drawing a color. Okay. Now, for geostatistics, that color is just associated with a concentration value. It's an estimate of what the concentration might be. But for geostatistics, that number really just comes from a probability distribution at that block. So if you imagine if I had 50 blocks there by 50 blocks, so 2,500 blocks, in geostatistics what I end up with is 2,500 probability distributions. At each one of those little blocks I have one probability distribution. And that probability distribution, perhaps I choose the mean, or the median, and I use that if I'm forced to report a single answer. But I can use that probability distribution just sort of as a model of how uncertain I am. Okay? So it may be that in the case of ordinary Cregan, under an assumption of normality, that I report 3 picocuries per gram, but in reality, the normal distribution is pretty wide, and most of the PDF is located anywhere from 0 to 6. Okay, so that kind of spatial uncertainty is kind of presented, or is easier to see. We can't plot 2,500 probability distributions; it would just look like a mess on the screen. But what we can do is we can say, well, if you have the specific decision criteria in mind, then we can go to that probability distribution function at every single block and calculate what's the probability of exceeding it, if that helps.
And
so in a way, these PDFs then become a model for our uncertainty about the prediction at each point.
And there's one question, and then we're caught up on questions. Setting up geostatistical models in SATA can be complicated. Why not provide a default model configuration like Surfer? And this is from Carl Steinman from Chicago, but it could very well be from one of our sponsors. How'd you handle that?
Okay. Well, there's two schools of thought on that. Yes, there is. We feel a little bit of pressure along those lines to sort of take a look at your data set, look at how far the spatial extent, the easting and the northings are going, and sort of make a guess about maybe what the search neighborhood ought to look like, how long it should be. Maybe we can just make a rough guess that the correlation structure is half the distance across the site. But in reality, I am very worried about those kinds of things for several reasons. One is that these parameters that go into these geostatistical models are important. I mean, many times you're trying to build a case, or you're a defensible argument for why you should tell the bulldozers to dig over there on the left-hand side of the site. Well, why did you tell them that? Well, it's because we did a spatial analysis, which produced this contour map or this uncertainty map. That spatial analysis was firmly rooted in our understanding of the correlation structure, which we modeled very carefully. We looked at anisotropy in all directions and tested for it, and we're fairly certain that this is the structure we're seeing on the site, and it is makes sense with the data values we have. Versus, well, I put it into Surfer, or I put it into SATA, or I put it into ArcGIS, and I push this button, and out came an answer. So it's an issue of credibility versus, can anybody really use it? So we certainly appreciate that question. It's one that we're struggling with, even on this particular development. One of the things we're tasked to do is to see if we can find a balance that goes beyond just guessing for you or putting a number in that makes a pretty picture pop out versus usability. So we hope it comes up with something good. And we are familiar with the Surfer software.
But we should reemphasize that, you know, once you put in some of those basic types of parameters, there are some autofit routines and version 4 say that allow you to fit models based upon that parameterization. We did get another question here, following up on the uncertainty discussion. Am I reading this lower left graph properly when I say the red and purple areas are very clearly either above or below the limit, but the yellows and greens are rather uncertain? And the answer to that is yes. Red means very clearly above, purple means very clearly below, and yellow and green are uncertain in a probability context, with respect to a given decision criterion. And then when it's just displaying a concentration range, then red's going to be high and purple's going to be low and green and yellow are going to be in between. Moving on to risk assessment.
And Tom, I would also just point out that we have 20 minutes left.
Hey, John, Mike, do we get cut off at 2:30?
Wake up, Michael.
Sorry, I was on mute. Yeah, yes, we will.
Okay. All right, thanks. So, risk assessment, slide 16, I guess it is, spatial implementation of risk assessment. I just wanted to point out that SATA does do conventional risk assessment in the sense that you go through and you have a bunch of contaminants that you've imported into a SATA file. They're displayed spatially in SATA. You can define a polygon, which includes all those samples that were collected within a given exposure area, for example, and then SATA will go ahead and calculate a confidence limit and go through and do tabular types of risk results that you would typically use for ecological and human health risk output. But that one of the advantages of hooking up the risk assessment routines to this GIS as we have in SATA is that there are some clear advantages to spatially implementing risk assessment as well. For one thing, that spatial information is retained when you go through the risk assessment process, when risk assessment is used to determine whether or not a site needs to be remediated and which areas of the site need to be cleaned up. And we'll see some of that with some of the decision analysis applications at the end, where you can define sort of an efficient cleanup area that will sort of minimize your cost of remediating a site, yet still meet your risk assessment goals at a site. And Robert's already touched on some of this, but there's also ways to efficiently collect data and sort of determine areas where you have high or low probabilities of exceeding risk assessment criteria, in addition to just typical cleanup concentrations. And so that using risk assessment in the spatial way can help better maximize use of limited resources as well as adequately characterize the exposure distribution. But let's move on to slide 17, ecological and human health risk. SATA implements EPA methods for both eco and human health risk assessments. On the human health side, we allow you to calculate site-specific preliminary remediation goals, as well as perform exposure assessment modeling for humans for a number of different land use scenarios. Shipped with SEDA include iris and HEAS toxicity databases, which are used for calculating the risk from the exposures that are calculated in SEDA. And then we have, as best we could, sort of summarize all the EPA default exposure parameters for different land use scenarios, and those are also included in the software and can be used to generate human health risk calculations, either in a tabular format or in a spatial one. On the eco side, one of our colleagues here at the University of Tennessee, Chris Welsh, has taken a lot of effort to sort of accumulate a number of different ecological benchmark database sources, and those are also shipped with SEDA. So for soil sediment, surface water, and some tissue residue for biota concentrations, you can go ahead and perform screening against benchmark values that are contained in the SEDA software that are part of the distribution. And then SEDA also does terrestrial exposure dose modeling. So we have 21 different terrestrial species where you can do, you can go ahead and calculate exposures from different concentrations, for different contaminants at your sites. So in, moving on to slide 18, human health risk calculations, you'll see the different media that we cover for human health risk: soil, sediment, surface water, and groundwater. We have 5 default exposure scenarios. These are land uses for residential, industrial, recreational, agricultural, and excavation. These are depicted in the form, on the upper right form of this slide, where here when you open up SEDA and you have the human health risk assessment set up, you can then see the default values, and then you can also change them and save them to your SEDA file to reflect site-specific considerations or local guidance that you need to implement that's different from sort of national guidelines for exposure parameters. We include the basic types of exposure pathways for human health risk. These include ingestion, inhalation, thermal contact, and various food chain pathways associated with the agricultural scenario. We do have iris and HEAS toxicity databases. We have provided this information by the Risk Assessment Information System, which is an online resource you may know of that is also comes out of our group here at the University of Tennessee and the Oak Ridge National Laboratory. And what these do is provide the information that's necessary to calculate carcinogenic and non-carcinogenic risk. And various physical parameters for modeling that are used by, for example, some of the food chain pathways as well as some of the ingestion and inhalation exposure pathways include bioaccumulation factors, emission factors, permeability constants. All those are exposed for the different contaminants that you would have in your SEDA file. You can make changes to the default value or to the default regression equations you use to generate these types of physical parameters that are used in the exposure models. Moving on to slide 19, for human health risk, we have different types of output for human health. We have the tabular outputs, so the PRG calculations allow you to calculate risk, calculate cleanup concentrations given a particular risk scenario, a land use pathway, a target risk or hazard level, different pathways that you determine to be of concern at the site. And SEDA will present you with a table of what the cleanup concentrations are for that combination of input parameters. You can then perform PRG screens with those site-specific PRGs, and SEDA will tell you for a given area that you selected with the polygon whether or not you've exceeded that PRG at that site. And then that can be used as a means to kick out or retain contaminants in a screening type of context. Also, there are forward risk capabilities in SEDA, so this is your typical baseline risk assessment where you'd have a list of contaminants, and this is on the upper right of slide 19. You'd have a list of contaminants that you've retained for the risk assessment. SEDA would go through and calculate the exposure concentration for your exposure area, apply the risk models that you've selected for the land use and pathways that you selected, and give you the carcinogenic risk or hazard that is necessary, that is related to the site concentrations that you have. It should be noted at this point that we do need to have an update of the human health risk assessment piece. We still use sort of the older log normal or normal UCL 95 to determine exposure concentration. More and more of the country are using to pro-UCL type methods or in particular like the Chebyshev UCL. And that is something that we need to upgrade SEDA for the next release so that we are conforming with those types of calculation of confidence limits for exposure concentration. It is possible to take pro-UCL or your own type of method for calculating an exposure concentration, bring those into SEDA just for the purposes of using the human health risk models, and people have done that. So those are the tabular outputs. For the mapping type outputs, you can see in conjunction in the lower left-hand corner, in conjunction with a map or maps of interpolated concentration values, SEDA will also present interpolated maps of risk, which can be used for determining areas that are above some risk threshold. And also you can do spatial screens as seen in the lower right, where you're just actually looking at each point and capturing the risk essentially from exposure to that point and determining which sample areas are giving you a problem. This is not baseline type risk assessment information in the sense of a clean or not clean decision, but it can help you sort of design remedial actions to address risk concerns at a site. Moving on to ecological capabilities in SEDA. SEDA implements various forms of ecological risk assessment methods. I've already mentioned the benchmark database that has been assembled here at the university, as well as the exposure modeling for over 20 different species we have. We have default exposure parameters for those terrestrial species where they're available, and that's usually from the ecological soil screening level guidance. And you can use the risk capabilities of SEDA, the eco capabilities, to do either typical benchmark screening or ecological dose exposures. So if I move on to slide 21, you can see ecological benchmark screening. This is allows you to for the contaminants that you've imported into your SEDA file. For this display, for the upper right-hand corner, what we see is a surface water ecological benchmark retrieval form. And what this allows you to do is actually click on different benchmark sources that we have for surface water that are in the SEDA file. And you can simply click on the different benchmark values that you're concerned about, and it'll display those values. It'll also display ratios or perform screening to let you know at which contaminants you have at your site that are an exceedance of different benchmark sources. And the way this usually works in terms of actually doing a type of assessment at a site is that you would set up a hierarchy of benchmarks from your most important to your least important benchmarks, since not all benchmark sources contain all contaminants. And you would then go through and SEDA would find from the highest to lowest in your hierarchy the first benchmark source which contains a benchmark for your contaminant. Now, a lot of people really like the histogram function for the ecological benchmarks, which are shown in the lower right of slide 21. What this does is, for example, for a contaminant that you have, I can't see on mine. Let's see where it went. For a given contaminant, I think this is arsenic, it'll query the SEDA benchmark database for all the benchmark forms, benchmark sources that have a valid benchmark and display them in a histogram range. So you can see what the range of benchmark values are from different regulatory sources for a given contaminant for ecological benchmarks. Sometimes there are reasons for this range. There can be more or less sensitive species to a given contaminant in different areas of the country that are used to derive these benchmarks, but also they can just be a function of how conservative the sets of assumptions were to derive benchmarks from that particular benchmark source. Moving on to ecological dose exposures. SEDA calculates dose. This is slide 22. SEDA calculates dose similar to human health
from a number of different exposure pathways for 20 different species. You see the long-tailed weasel there in the lower left, and you can parameterize that to reflect site-specific values for the different species that we have. You can parameterize males, females, or juveniles differently. You can also use the default EPA soil screening level values that are provided in that guidance document from EPA. And then for calculating bioaccumulation to those different receptors, the lower right shows a typical terrestrial modeling contaminant parameter form where you can select contaminants you have at your site and use default values for bioaccumulation, for example, for either the BAF values or for the regression relationships. And you can change those because that's often done for ecological risk assessment that you reflect site-specific conditions when calculating those that bioaccumulation in the food chain. I think we had two questions.
We have 5 minutes.
Is there an uncertainty value associated with the risk mapping? Oh, I'm sorry. We already got that one. SSL stands for soil screening level. If you are familiar with the concept of PRGs or preliminary remediation goals, this is the ecological equivalent. So it's essentially a cleanup concentration for a given receptor and for a given set of exposure assumptions. There's also a question from Lila Goslink from Austin, Texas. Can state or local specific benchmarks be entered and used for screening? And that's a good segue to slide 23, which is custom criteria. And what this custom criteria allows you to do is to say, all right, and say that we have these different benchmark sources and we allow you to calculate human health PRGs, but if you have other regulatory sources that you need to use or ecological benchmarks we don't have, or, for example, you need to use the human health region 9 PRGs and not calculate your own, you can bring those in into SEDA and use those for screening in similar ways that we've seen for human health and ecological risk. We just have a couple minutes left, so Robert, we'll go ahead with decision analysis.
Yeah, so slide 24 is basically just sort of a rehash of some of the major principles we've covered. On the right-hand corner, you see that we are able to bring support decision-making by bringing in simple spatial screens, sampling strategies. We're able to also plot spatial risks and actually develop areas of concern, and there are actually a couple of different frameworks for how you define an area of concern. They might want to take a look at those. And also with those area of concern, we can publish the volumes associated with them. And we have some rudimentary cost versus risk reduction type plots that might be somewhat informed from a cost perspective. Moving on to slide 25, this slide here is basically to point out that this always can be done in either two-dimensional or three-dimensional data. And this is sort of a view of our in-house 3D visualization module. Slide 26 is kind of interesting. These models are quite involved, in some cases requiring a large number of parameters or assumptions. And so SEDA has a way to report everything that went into a particular result. So, for example, we see our area of concern map on the left-hand side. Well, that's based on a geostatistical model. It's based on a human health model. It was based on a correlation structure that was based on a particular query of data, et cetera, et cetera. You can select, say that we'll analyze that result, come up with the ingredients of the result, and you can automatically document those in a report. The last slide is just for those of people who are SEDA 3 users. There was some complaint about speed and constantly having to regenerate results. Now SEDA has a results gallery where you can store and save results without having to regenerate them each time. And that is our whirlwind demonstration of SEDA. It normally takes 3 days. We apologize if it went too fast. But we encourage you to go to the SEDA website and look at additional reference materials there as well as training courses.
A quick question. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, for the quaking method, how do you determine the number of grades? Like you mentioned, 50 by 50 or 10 by 10. How do you determine the number of grades you're going to use?
Yeah, the grid, selection of your grid cells or your block sizes.
Yeah.
It can depend upon what you want to accomplish. In some cases, each one of those blocks represents a remedial unit. Say the example would be the size of a backhoe scoop, or they might be an exposure unit, or they, in some of the decision frameworks, they might be a combination. So I'd encourage you to take a look at the help documentation on SATA under area of concerns, and I think there's some, I think there's a discussion there on that.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Hi guys, this is Mike. I think we've come up against our time limit here. Thanks for your presentation, and thanks everybody for listening in and attending. And keep looking at TechDirect for more seminar announcements in the future. Thanks.